Conversations from the Edge is a series of interviews and discussions with the leading scientists, intellectuals, activists, and public figures on the defining issues of our time. I am your host, Theo Cullen-Moose, and I'm an 18-year-old climate activist and writer from a small offshore island on Ireland's west coast. Today I'm joined by John Sweeney, Emeritus Professor of Geography at NUI Maynooth. Over his distinguished 40-year career, John has taught in universities in Ireland, North America, and Africa, published over 100 scientific papers, and contributed to the IPCC reports. In this deep dive into the science of the climate crisis, we discussed everything from the nitty-gritty of climate science to the challenges of being a climate scientist in an age of inaction. The complete interview runs over an hour and 20 minutes, and thus it has been split into two parts for your convenience. In this first episode, you'll hear John talk about extreme weather patterns in relation to climate, the Siberian heat wave, and climate modeling. Thank you so much for joining us, and John, it's an absolute pleasure to have you. My first question for you, I guess, is when did you first learn about the threat posed by climate change?
Thanks, Theo. Well, I guess I did my early work, as you said, in air pollution. And when I came to Ireland in the late 1970s, way back then, I began to look at rainfall in Ireland. Of course, you can't be living in Ireland without appreciating rainfall. And what I began to look at was the way in which rainfall, as a geographer, rainfall varied very much across Ireland, depending on which direction the wind was coming from. So if you're in the west of Ireland with a northwesterly wind, you get something like four or five times on average as much rainfall as if you're in the southeast, or maybe around Wexford or Rosslare, that kind of area. And I began to assemble then the annual rainfall map of Ireland based on how often did the wind blow from these directions to give that rainfall quantity that was being delivered? And it began to occur to me then as I did that, and I assembled 20 or 30 stations and manually interpolated all of the daily rainfall totals, I began to think, well, what happens if the wind direction changes, or we don't get as much westerly winds, or we get more easterly winds? And I began to think, well, you know, Cork, for example, gets as much rain with an easterly wind as it does with a westerly wind, whereas somewhere like Malin Head gets most of its rain from the west and the northwest. So I began to ask the question, well, suppose the westerlies become less frequent, for example, how would that change Irish rainfall? And that led me on to start saying, well, when we have less rainfall, say during a dry summer, what are the other characteristics that we get in Ireland? And I began to look at the dry summers and realized that, well, they were a couple of degrees warmer usually on average as well. So I began to say, well, suppose Ireland gets warmer, is this what will happen to our rainfall? And this was long before we had computer models of anything. It was really when things had to be done on paper and nothing else. And as a result of that, I began to see that if Ireland, even at that stage, there was some speculation of warming occurring, even if Ireland warmed up a couple of degrees, here's what would happen to our rainfall. And that led me on then to a lot of work on modelling changes in Irish climate, which began to prosper, I suppose, as computer models became a little more easily available, as we began to get the kind of more sophisticated models that we could input data into. And from there then, it was a case of modelling what might happen to Irish climate, firstly, in a primitive way in those days, and then secondly saying, well, what would the impact of all of that be in terms of floods, in terms of water supply, in terms of agriculture, in terms of biodiversity? And at that time, there was very little work being done on these areas. And Maynooth was therefore able to establish, I suppose, a small school of researchers, which we began to use to look at that kind of question of future scenarios for Irish climate, of possible impacts which future scenarios would have on Irish climate. And that, of course, then began to alert people, I suppose, to the fact that, well, if this is going to happen, we need to start thinking a bit about how we're going to adapt to it, how we're going to, I suppose, reorientate and reposition certain aspects of our society, of our economy, in order that we don't become a loser in the future. So that kind of was where I began to move in with that little school of researchers. We numbered at our peak about 20 PhD and postdoc students in Maynooth. It's about the same, I think, that is there today. But we did a lot of the early work on climate change then, you know, up until, I suppose, the middle of the current decade.
Okay, thank you. The thing that you mentioned about rainfall is actually something that this year, here on Clare Island on the West Coast, I think that I've really noticed in terms of how rainfall patterns can change quite significantly. So for example, just the local data for the nearest weather station, I believe that's Newport. In this May, there was roughly a quarter of the rainfall recorded last year and in 2018. And then in June, it wasn't quite double, but it was close enough to double the amount of rainfall in those two previous years. And I think that May was actually the driest year, just in the Newport weather station, the driest year on record for this area. To what extent are patterns like this affected by climate change? To what extent can we attribute it to increases in temperature that we know are happening?
Well, you're right, firstly, about the changes that have been apparent in 2020. For much of the last winter, 2019-20, we were under a fairly normal kind of westerly regime in Ireland. So we were getting a lot of air masses coming from the Atlantic and giving us the usual copious amounts of winter rain, especially, for example, in the west of Ireland, which you wouldn't be too familiar with. And then, you know, it continued into February. And in February, we had the wettest February ever recorded in Ireland. We had some really big storms, like Storm Jorg, for example, in February. And there were very dramatic scenes of container lorries being blown over, of damage being done. And then that regime of Atlantic air, if you like, stopped. And we began to get more continental air. And we moved then from a westerly maritime regime into a more continental air mass, which was bringing very moisture deficient air masses, if you like, much more drier air from the east and from the south. We didn't get the bitterly cold Siberian air to any great extent last winter, but we were getting drier air masses from the continent. And this made the spring that we had really dry, as you mentioned. We had, I think, the driest spring on record in parts of Eastern Ireland. I mean, there were months in the Phoenix Park where there was only a few millimetres of rainfall, much, much less than normal. It was a little better in the west, but it wasn't anyway like the normal spring you have in the west either. And that again changed, of course, in June, much to people's annoyance, because we were, I think, hoping for a nice dry summer. And instead, we got a fairly maritime summer as well. We didn't have any spectacular heat waves. Now, we've seen a lot of that in the past few years in Ireland, a lot more of those kind of lurches between extreme events. And we had, of course, a very severe drought again a few years back. In the springtime, we had the wettest winter on record over most of Ireland in 2015-16. We had the stormiest winter we know on record in 2013-14. So we've been getting those kinds of extreme events more commonly than we used to. And whenever people are asked, is this climate change? There has been a sort of stock answer that climatologists have had to give. And that stock answer has always been, well, we can't really attribute an individual event or a short-term event to climate change because it has happened in the past, because there may be natural processes at work. And so, you know, we can only say that, well, this event is probably more likely to have occurred as a result of climate change, or it's increasing in frequency along the lines we would expect to see with climate change. And that's been the answer that climatologists have been given for the past decade. And I mean, I've been besieged by the media with every extreme event. They said, is this climate change? And I've had to give that answer until this year. And this year, things have changed. And they've changed quite considerably because there has been quite a significant advance in climate science occurring over the past 18 months to 2 years. And that advance has come about because unlike the early days that I talked about a moment ago, when we had either no models or one model to run, we were very limited in those days by computer power. And as we all know, computing power has increased exponentially in the past few years. And what this has meant for climate science has been that, well, you don't need to run only one model anymore. You can run a model maybe 1,000 times now. And you can look at, first of all, the spread of data that you get as an output to give you an idea of whether it's consistent or widely spaced and how much reliability you can place on it. But more importantly, you can ask the what if questions now. What if I run this model 500 times with pre-industrial levels of carbon dioxide? And what if I run this same model now 500 times with the current levels of carbon dioxide? Mm-hmm. How often would we get an event, an extreme event occurring, such as the wettest February or the driest spring? But more importantly, if we look at extreme events, especially on a wider scale, we've had some really interesting outputs. And the first one, I suppose, was when they applied this principle to the very severe heat wave that occurred, especially in France in 2019. You may remember, it was a really horrible summer there and in much of Western Europe, where temperatures got well into the 40s in terms of rise. And the question you can ask your model is, well, how much more likely would this have been as a result of increased CO2 or in the absence of CO2? And the figure that comes out there is about 10 times more likely, at least. So it's giving us a power of what we call attribution. But this same principle has been applied this year to an extreme event which has gone almost unnoticed among the public. And that extreme event occurred in northern Siberia, not a place that you get a lot of publicity around. It occurred as a result of data coming from a small town called Verkhoyansk in northern Siberia. Now, Verkhoyansk is it's not a place you'll have heard of, but I've been using it as a classic example for 40 years of a continental climate, because it's a place away up in the north of Siberia, so far away from the sea, that it gets really hot, really cold winters. It's the most northerly inhabited place on a continuous basis in the world, a village of a few thousand people. But during the summer, it gets a very short summer, like Clare Island, for example. It only has a couple of months above 16 degrees centigrade. So it's a really extreme, and during this time of the year in December, its average temperature is minus 45 degrees centigrade. So it's a pretty cold place to live in. You know, I've got a very dramatic picture of a young lady bringing home the milk, which is a slab of white frozen milk, and that's how they collect it. You don't venture out very far in those temperatures. But the key thing here is that this summer, Verkhoyansk hit temperatures of 38 degrees centigrade. Now, 38 degrees centigrade is 5 degrees hotter than we've ever had in Ireland. And this is a way up, not too far from the north coast of Siberia. So it was very exceptional indeed. And applying the attribution principle, the models suggested that it was up to 1,000 times more likely that it would have occurred with human influence than in the absence of human influence. So if you like, the dice is now increasingly throwing up positive, conclusive evidence that climate change is causing those extremes. And it's giving, if you like, the argument that the last argument that the skeptics had, in a way, that all of this is natural. It's now more or less dismissing that. And we can now say with much, much more confidence that what we're seeing in extremes is human, is increasingly human-induced increases in their frequency. Why, you might well ask, is this happening? Well, one possibility would seem to be, and this is where the research is going at the moment, would seem to be that the jet streams on which our weather is born are becoming a little less reliable and a little more variable. Now, the jet streams bring our weather systems across the Atlantic to Ireland, and usually they whistle around the globe in a very rapid airflow. But increasingly, they're becoming more meandering. They're meandering north and meandering south. And with that, they're bringing extreme warm weather south and extreme cold weather extreme cold weather south and extreme warm weather north, and giving us a locking in of weather systems which don't move as quickly and give us prolonged periods of either extreme hot or extreme dry or even sometimes extreme cold weather, such as we had way back in 2010 in Ireland, a very cold winter. Why is this happening is, of course, the basis of a lot of research at the moment. And one hypothesis, which is growing in, I suppose, substance, is that we are warming up the high latitudes and warming up the poles much more quickly than the rest of the world is warming up, maybe three times as quickly in the Arctic as in the lower latitudes. And this is what may well be behind giving the jet streams less in the way of impetus, because the jet streams depend on the temperature difference between the low latitudes and the high latitudes to drive them. And if that gradient is decreased, rather like a river which has no kind of impetus to move quickly, then it begins to meander and begins to give us those increased extreme events with greater frequency. And that's why, in a way, we need to be very concerned about those extremes as being, if you like, the harbingers of climate change on a bigger scale. They may well be telling us that what we're doing to the globe in terms of the circulation of the atmosphere may well be, if you like, instigating extremes which we really don't want to see happening with greater frequency in the future, and which will cause more hardship and more expense in terms of adaptation in the future as well. It's a long-winded answer to your question, but that's the gist of it.
That's very interesting, especially the Siberian heat wave that you mentioned there. I think that's something you cannot deny the shock value of hearing 38 degrees Celsius in Siberia. That's something that to me would indicate, even if I didn't know anything else, that there's something very, very wrong going on.
Yes, and it had a consequence as well in very recent weeks, in that because Siberia was undergoing such a heat wave, the Arctic Ocean north of Siberia did not refreeze as normal. The Laptev Sea, which normally by October is among the earliest parts of the Arctic to refreeze, was all open ocean. And the Great Northern Sea Route, which is now developed around Siberia, I think there were 450 voyages during August alone between Europe and Asia. But that failure of the Laptev Sea to refreeze means that probably we're facing a new record low in Arctic sea ice in the next season. And that's part and parcel as well of the change that we're seeing between a reflective snow or ice covered surface and an open sea surface, which absorbs more heat and feeds back into accentuated warming, therefore, and more melting of ice. So it's a kind of a loop that we don't really want to see if that is having an impact on the atmosphere above.
That's actually one of the things that I wanted to ask you just about that. This hypothesis that the high latitudes or the high latitudes, the poles, are warming quicker than the regions closer to the equator. The feedback loop you just mentioned of melting ice in the Arctic, not reflecting back the sunlight and the ocean absorbing the heat. How do these two things interact together? And going forward over a longer time span, what impact can we expect to see from them?
Well, the problem of what's called the ice albedo feedback is simply that once you reduce the area of sea ice, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, you transform the surface from a shiny surface which reflects heat and reflects the solar input very quickly to a dark surface. And that dark surface of ocean, it means that the heat, if you like, can go down deeper into the ocean firstly, and it can be retained a little longer and mixed through the ocean as well. But then it can act also to keep the ocean warm enough to stop refreezing and to melt even more ice when the next summer comes. So there is this kind of feedback effect. Now, the impact, of course, is ecological. Firstly, I mean, we're removing the summer sea ice by about 4% per year at the moment. And that has an ecological impact, obviously, on animals and on ecosystems, which depend for their existence on the summer sea ice. It also has an impact as well on indigenous societies, who in turn depend on them. But from a climatic point of view, it does, as I was hinting earlier, influence where the boundary between, if you like, the cold air mass chilled from below and the warm air mass chilled from the ocean below interact, so that the polar jet, the polar front, is more likely to move further north in that situation as the ocean warms further. And that will have impacts on, for example, where our storm systems travel to in terms of where they will form, but also where they will migrate to, and whether we will have, for example, in the future in Ireland, less storms than we have at the moment, or storms that may well be bigger than we have at the moment if the ocean is warmer and if there's more energy going into the air above it. So we have this kind of, it's quite a complicated interrelationship between ocean and atmosphere in terms of generating storm activity and also determining where it will go. And a lot of that will be affected by the changes in the high latitude. There will be concerns, for example, that the Great Oceanic Conveyor Belt, which drives our Gulf Stream, which drives the North Atlantic Drift, will be affected by melting ice, cold water coming from the poles during the summer and inducing, if you like, the warm oceanic current to cool more quickly and plunge to great depths before it reaches Europe. And that's been of some concern. It's not likely to happen until we get above 4 degrees of warming. But if that was to happen, it would have a very serious effect on climate across the Northern Hemisphere. And, you know, it would certainly reverse a lot of the warming that may well have happened in some parts of the Northern Hemisphere by then. So there's a very close relationship between what we're doing, what's happening in the Arctic and what's happening in the ocean south of those ice sheets, and consequently in the atmosphere above those oceanic areas where, you know, most of the heat we put into the atmosphere, 90% of the extra heat we put in to the atmosphere from global warming goes into the ocean. It's locked up in the ocean even more. So we, you know, what's left over to warm the atmosphere is a very small amount. So the ocean is crucial in controlling warming on land and in the air above it. So, you know, it's something we can't ignore as a vital factor in determining future climate.
One thing that I think I've read a lot is that a lot of these events, like the extreme weather is being seen in Siberia, the extent to which sea ice is being lost, that a lot of these things are happening quicker than models had expected. So my question is, do you think that models are underestimating in some cases the speed with which climate change is occurring? And moving forward, what do you think, if that is the case, that might mean?
Well, I think in the past, skeptics often accused the models of exaggerating what was happening, exaggerating the speed. And, you know, there was a long-standing argument, especially in the first decade of this century, whereby skeptics were saying, we haven't warmed since 1998 up until 2014 or 2015. The models have been predicting we'd go so much warmer than we've been, and so the models are wrong. And it is true that models tend to be, I suppose, simplifications of reality, and we mustn't forget that they're never, you know, 100% accurate. But they have become a lot more accurate in the past few years than ever they were. And they have begun to demonstrate that accuracy by hindcasting, by looking at what's going on in the past and modeling the actual observed changes. And when they are tested on that kind of scale of looking at, you know, the changes since we had instrumental records, and if they can replicate that well, it gives a lot of confidence that they can replicate, or they can estimate what's going to happen in the future. And they have been much, much more successful in doing that. One of the great, I suppose, other breakthroughs in the past couple of years has been the way in which we calibrate models. There was, for example, there's a key parameter with all climate models that you have to put in. And you have to say to the model, what will you tell me will happen to global temperature if CO2 is doubled? And that's like the gearing under which the model works. Now, if you tell the model, oh, it's going to be 4 degrees, then it's going to overpredict probably quite a lot of what's been happening in the past. And if you tell it it's 1 degree, the model is going to say, oh, don't get worried about global warming at all. And you have these two kind of contradictory parameters, one of which has been fastened on by climate skeptics to say that, you know, we've done our calculations and climate sensitivity, as this is called, is only around 1 degree. So even if we double CO2, we're not going to warm by more than 1 degree. That's been a standard argument of a lot of climate skeptics. On the other hand, you will get people who are on the other extreme. But this year, the evidence is coming out that the uncertainties between those two extremes has been reduced considerably. And the next IPCC report will, in all probability, say that we're now pretty confident that climate sensitivity will be around about 2.5 to 3 degrees. In other words, double CO2, you'll get 2.5 to 3 degrees. You won't get necessarily too much more, but you certainly won't get only a 1 degree warming. And that again has been, I suppose, quite an advancement to give models more in the way of credibility. It is true to say that models tend to be conservative, that there are things built into models like cloud parameterizations, like that ice albedo feedback effect, which we don't know an awful lot about, like aerosols, we don't know an awful lot yet about. But increasingly, the science is becoming clear on all those topics, and models are becoming much, much more reliable than they were. And also, of course, because of our computing capability, we can make them much more complex than they were before. So in the early days when I was modeling, you know, you had always what you might call a billiard ball Earth. That was your model. You know, there was very little extra to add to that. But then, you know, you began to be able to add in the oceans. You began to be able to add in the biosphere. We began to be able to add in the terrestrial changes. We began to be able to add in the pollution loading to the atmosphere, all sorts of extra things which made it much, much more complex, but also gave a better approximation to reality at the end of the day. So we still can't project short-term changes with models. We can't say what the weather's going to be like in 3 months' time, but we can make a stab at what it's likely to show in terms of climate, the long-term averages, in 30 years' time. And we're much more confident about that, I would say, than ever has been the case before. So yes, they have their problems still. They have uncertainties. And we have to recognize that they are approximations only of reality. But I do think we can place more faith in models than we could a decade or so ago. And therefore, we have to act on them.
Mm. Would you say it's fair to say that the models we have are our best tools to understand what's going on with the climate crisis?
Yeah, I mean, it would be lovely if we could develop a physical model of the Earth atmosphere system, you know, that we could go and look at something happening in kind of a tank with a globe and put a heater on it and see what would happen in great detail. But the Earth atmosphere system is so complex that we can never hope to do that in terms of a physical model. So we have to go towards conceptual computer models as a consequence. They are our only option, I think, for the future, but I think they are options which we can offer a great deal of, or we can put a great deal of reliance on. But we do have to recognize that, you know, models offer a more holistic view of the whole system than maybe picking out a small part of the Earth atmosphere system and drawing conclusions maybe on what happens in urban areas or what happens in rural areas and trying to extrapolate those beyond the capabilities of the area concerned. So yeah, I think they are our only future in a way.
Just one question that I wanted to ask you was about the, obviously there's been the pandemic since February and March in Ireland and across the globe. And that has had an effect on both the coverage of the climate crisis in the media and on the governance of climate issues. Obviously COP26 in Glasgow was postponed by a whole year, and the whole UNFCCC, their whole sort of framework has also been postponed. I know that the Bonn conference was postponed as well, which was supposed to take place in June, I think it was, as a lead up to COP26. So it seems to me like climate has in some ways been forgotten about. What do you think the implications of waiting further in terms of acting on this crisis are from a scientific point of view?
Well, I think the latest estimates suggest that the global emissions of carbon dioxide at least will be falling by between 4% and 7% in 2020 as a consequence of COVID. And that's coming about mostly from reductions in transport. I think we have to remember that other sources of greenhouse gases will have continued as normal, in particular methane emissions and nitrous oxide emissions. So I don't expect to see a major reduction in the overall global total, but I would expect to see us having, if you like, bought a year or two in terms of going back to where we were maybe 3 or 4 years earlier. And that itself is, I suppose, something, but it's not how you should be managing climate change. You don't want a pandemic to force change in that way. Concurrent with that, of course, there has been a preoccupation in the media with the pandemic, which is understandable to some extent. I think we will see concerns of climate re-emerging once this pandemic is over. And I say that for a couple of reasons. And the first one is, I suppose, that as people have been sitting at home, they have become rather more acutely conscious of the natural world outside their window. And they've been looking at the seasons change. They've been thinking a little more about what drives nature. If they're living in cities, they've been noticing the purer air quality that they've been able to taste when they've been outside. And I think there has been a continuing sort of, if you like, consciousness of climate and nature, and climate and biodiversity in particular, in the past year, which will not go away and which will resurrect itself when the pandemic is over. And that, secondly, also is leading to, I suppose, people thinking more about their transport modes, more about how they're organizing their life in terms of commuting, in terms of transportation systems. And that will also, I think, come back as underlying thoughts for people when this thing is all over. So those two things, I think, will be influential. But it's true to say that climate change has slipped off the agenda of many of the media companies almost completely in the past 9 months. I found it almost impossible to find media stories in the press or on the television compared to a year or so ago when we had climate weeks, we had all sorts of things happening. And we had the climate strikes from Fridays for Future as well, which obviously have had to be suspended too. Now, those things will all come back. And I'm quite confident that this time next year, we will be talking much more about climate than we are this time this year. And it will be important, therefore, for people like yourselves and Fridays for Future to put climate back on the agenda once the preoccupation with the pandemic is over. And I don't think that will be too hard, quite honestly, because we're seeing signs, for example, that Europe and the EU are still moving on, still progressing their legal and their organizational structures to cope with future changes in climate to address them. So they will come back onto the agenda as well, and the media will respond. So I'm not too disappointed, I'm not too despondent that it has slipped temporarily low. It often happened in the past. You know, we would get major events, major extreme events, and there'd be a lot of hype about climate, which would then disappear 2 months later. We have very short memories. We don't remember in Ireland the floods in February at this stage on the Shannon, you know, but those things will come back into our consciousness.
That was Professor John Sweeney speaking about the science of the climate crisis and what we've learned over the past year. This is part one of a two-part series. In the next episode, you'll hear John talk about the Paris Agreement 5 years on, the politics of climate action, and how we can better communicate the urgency of this crisis. Thanks again to John for taking the time to virtually sit down with me and discuss these issues. Until then, thank you for listening to Conversations from the Edge.